There's a sort of freedom, like an intrinsic knowledge, like you are part ocean, ocean is part you. You have salt water in your body. You are part of this.
Oceans, life underwater. A new podcast all about the oceans and the mind-blowing life within them.
Subscribe now to Oceans, Life Underwater on your favorite podcast app.
This is a Crowd podcast.
You see a lot of interesting things when you walk around Christchurch Airport, showing the very strong US influence here, right at the bottom of the world.
At the end of last year, I visited Christchurch International Airport. Every October, staff and scientists from all over the world flock through its single terminal, southbound. This is the gateway to Antarctica.
I'm just looking out at the Air New Zealand depot with some Air New Zealand planes sitting there. And just to my left is a transport plane which says New York Air Guard and has a US Air Force logo on it.
Christchurch International Airport has been the gateway to Antarctica since 1955, when the Americans began a series of icebound missions called Operation Deep Freeze. Now, there are 100 direct flights to the ice every year from this airport, carrying 5,500 passengers and 1,400 tons of cargo, including fresh food. This is where the Christchurch headquarters of the United States Antarctic Program lives, run by the National Science Foundation.
A rather ugly blue-grey building with no windows, behind barbed wire, where discoveries begin, it says, and underneath the National Science Foundation.
And just over the road lies the International Antarctic Centre, where visitors flock, hungry for a taste of the Antarctic experience. Its storm room is the closest you can get to experiencing the bitter Antarctic cold and brutal winds.
And parked in front of it, some Hagelins, which I don't have very fond memories of. These are the vehicles that take you around Antarctica, tracked vehicles, a very rocky ride indeed.
Around midnight on October the 30th, 2000, a plane touched down on this runway, the body of Rodney Marks, which had just spent 4 months frozen in the ice, had returned to the outside world. And that's how a cop and a coroner from Christchurch entered the stage. This is the secret history of Antarctica. It's Friday, the 12th of May, 2000, 7 p.m., around 20 minutes since Rodney Marks was pronounced dead.
Everyone came in the cafeteria, the doctor came in, announced it, and it was disbelief.
Dave had been one of the trauma team who'd responded to the doctor's emergency call after Rodney went into cardiac arrest.
How could this happen? Just a couple days ago, he was his normal self, and he was young. He didn't seem to have any health issues, and then all of a sudden, he's dead, and we're stuck there. Just everyone was in shock. Completely in shock.
I had no pre-warning or awareness of what had gone on over the previous hours or days, in fact.
Gene, one of Rodney's fellow astrophysicists.
None whatsoever. So for me, it was a bolt out of the blue.
There was utter confusion on the base. Nobody can make sense of what the doctor has just told them.
The immediate indication, I think, from him and what everyone else would have just accepted at that point was that his heart stopped. So what led up to that, there wasn't a lot of information at the time. As far as I was concerned and everyone that probably I was talking to at the time, it was like some tragic event that maybe he had some pre-existing condition.
Because everyone gets a very strict medical exam prior to going down. So that's the last thing you'd expect, is somebody to just dying. At that point, we didn't know anything.
Was there speculation? Were anybody speculating about what might have happened?
There were some conversations, like, did he have some kind of underlying heart disease? He had Tourette's, but very mild, so he had a little bit of a tick. Because of that, maybe some people started thinking, hey, well, maybe there were some other underlying health concerns there. But really, no one thought anything more than that.
The doctor wings the NSF, the National Science Foundation, in the United States. This is the agency in charge of America's polar program. He doesn't know what to tell them about what's just happened. Every event or thing I could think of left a loophole, he says. But the news spreads.
I found out when the head of the Antarctic program at the National Science Foundation called me up at home at 6 a.m.
This is Tony, Rodney's supervisor.
And unfortunately, my alarm was set for 7 a.m. and I was scheduled to go off to have an operation on my eye. They wanted me to call Rodney's parents, and I couldn't do it that day. I mean, I essentially had to go off and have my eye worked on. So our director of our center wound up calling Rodney's parents.
What was your reaction when you first heard this news?
Well, it was absolutely shocking. We were, you know, very upset and distressed. Yes, it was. We didn't have any details at that point, and there really wasn't anybody we could talk to about it. We just got the bare bones information.
As everyone tries to make sense of what's happened, the American authorities step in.
It was within 24 hours that the station manager was told by the National Science Foundation and I think by law enforcement that to go and investigate his work area, look for any evidence of anything.
The station manager, following orders, goes to the desk where Rodney had worked to collect any evidence. But there's nothing there. It had already been cleared. You might remember the name Darren Schneider. He's one of Rodney's good mates, and they'd spent a lot of time drinking together at the station bar. He was with Rodney when he died. In the immediate aftermath of Rodney's death, Darren took Sonia away from the upsetting scene. He then returned to Rodney's work area to clean up. These were his words about what he did next. They were read by an actor.
He was a pretty heavy drinker, and there was a lot of empty booze bottles there. I think I must have cleaned out at least 18 empty bottles, things ranging from tequila, Bundy, that type of booze. It was at that point I also threw away the weird bottle with the prawn on the side, because at that point I didn't think anything.
This bottle, with a motif of a prawn on the side, Darren thought Rodney had been gifted it from someone back home. It had curious writing on it that no one on base could understand. They thought maybe it was Portuguese. Tidying up his dead friend's workplace, though, in a state of utter shock, Darren thinks nothing of it and chucks the bottle away. So when the station manager goes back a few days later to look for clues, he finds nothing. Anywhere else in the world, the unexpected death of a healthy man in his early 30s would raise alarm bells. The area would be cordoned off, and all evidence preserved. Not in Antarctica, though. This mysterious object, the prawn bottle, and the question of what was in it and why, will hang over the investigation for years to come. But for now, the close-knit, grief-stricken crew put the death of their friend down to natural causes. A tragedy, but no grounds for suspicion.
We had no idea that there may have been some external event or effect that caused this.
Rodney Marks is dead, but what really happened? Enter two men, determined to solve the mystery, a coroner and a cop from Christchurch. The cop is Grant Wormald, an experienced detective, and in some respects, the hero of the story. Detective Wormald has been involved in many high-powered investigations in New Zealand, including into organised crime.
The mastermind behind a sophisticated smuggling ring that hid drugs worth millions of dollars in cosmetics, then sold them to gangs, has been jailed for 11 years. Detective Inspector Grant Wormald led the investigation into
Reed. We need to tighten up on the way that the law is interpreted and perhaps the way it's written. We are going to have a wee inquiry into that.
In 2022, I flew to Christchurch from where I live in Dunedin to see him. He came to meet me at my hotel, bringing with him the file on Marx's death. I got the strong sense he feels he never really got to the bottom of this case, despite his best efforts. So we talked it through, and I left with him saying yes, he'd give us an interview. And that's crucial, because he and the Christchurch coroner were two people without whom we would never even be close to the truth. Back in June 2000, a month after Rodney's death, Detective Wormald received a fax from the local coroner, a man called Richard McElroy. It's a request to start investigating the sudden death of a young man at the South Pole. It's a curious case. The man was Australian, but he died on an American base, and his body is due to be flown back to New Zealand. And according to New Zealand law, a coroner has the right to investigate a death on the basis of the body simply being present in the country. So McElroy will be heading the investigation, and he wants Detective Wormald on the case with him. Detective Wormald says later, of his reasons for taking it on, "I'd like to think that if my children went down there and something went wrong, someone would be responsible for finding out what happened. Someone should be required to give a damn." I'd hoped we'd hear from the detective himself in this series. He had agreed to an interview, but after months of writing to him and waiting, he unexpectedly pulled out. Explaining his withdrawal, he wrote, "Given the time since Rodney's death and the numerous articles written about him in which I've been quoted, police are of the view that there's nothing to be gained from being involved in your proposed podcast." His withdrawal from the series was unexpected, but given his crucial role, we are using his official files and previous statements to tell his side of the story. Detective Wormald also says he wants to respect the wishes of Rodney's family. In the past, they've been reluctant to speak to the media about Rodney's death. We've tried to reach Rodney's family throughout the making of this series, but were unsuccessful. Detective Wormald passed on a statement from them. This is what it said. "It's been decided we will not be participating in any form of public interview, article or documentary, now or in the future, regarding his life or death. We choose to maintain our sentiments and memories of Rodney as private, now and into the future." As a team, we discussed whether we ought to tell this most personal of stories about a tormented family still in the dark as to why their son died. But many of Rodney's friends have supported our investigation. And ultimately, we decided there's a bigger story here, a bleak picture of how mysterious deaths and crimes in general are dealt with in Antarctica. Which is what Detective Wormald, sitting at his desk in June 2000, reading through the bare details of the case, is about to find out. He's about to begin a grueling 8-year-long investigation, met at every turn by delays from the American authorities. It's an unequal fight, and one that he's determined to win. Who has jurisdiction in Antarctica? Is it really a land of no laws? It used to be. When humans first arrived at the South Pole in 1911, the Norwegians, led by Roald Amundsen, just beating Robert Falcon Scott's ill-fated expedition by a few weeks, they'd finally conquered an ungoverned land, inhabited only by seals, penguins and orcas. But in 1959, 12 countries came together amidst the chaos and terror of the Cold War and devised something called the Antarctic Treaty. hailed as one of the most successful international peace treaties of all time. It's the only piece of legislation that imposes any rules on this vast land. Members of the treaty follow a list of do's and don'ts.
As a scientist, you can go anywhere in the Antarctic to do science as long as you follow the rules of the Antarctic Treaty.
John Dudeney, Antarctic historian.
So that's a do. You're not allowed to have any radioactive activity in the Antarctic. It was the first area where there was a nuclear test ban treaty and also a ban on dumping radioactive waste.
If you go to Amundsen Scott Station, you'll see 12 flags circling the exact spot that marks the South Pole. 12 flags to commemorate those original treaty members. Argentina, Australia, Belgium, Chile, France, Japan, New Zealand, Norway, South Africa, the United Kingdom, the United States, and the USSR. Today, the treaty has 52 members. Its rules range from a ban on military activity and dumping radioactive waste to the protection of wildlife.
There are very complicated and comprehensive rules for the protection of particular areas, for the protection of the wildlife. You're not allowed to catch any of the wildlife, disturb any of the wildlife, certainly not eat any of the wildlife, unless you're in extremis. Basically, the Antarctic is reserved for peace and science. That's the fundamental issue.
It does seem like a recipe for disputes.
Well, amazingly, it isn't. Because, right, first of all, there's no permanent population. There's basically just research stations and now the tourist industry. And so the scope for there to be disputes is small. But there are obviously occasions when you do get territorial issues arise, but not very much. It's a little bit like the Emperor's new clothes, you know. People just let it go and allow the system to work because it has worked so very well since the treaty came into force in 1961.
Let's talk about potential jurisdictional issues. Mm. When something happens in one of these areas, one of these territories, who's in charge of it? Who's in charge of fixing it?
That is the problem that has been one that they've really not been able to find a solution to. I'm not a lawyer, but I would say it's almost insurmountable with the current framework.
The question of who has jurisdiction should be simple. For example, as a Kiwi, if I'm involved in a crime at the Kiwi base, Scott Base, which I've actually been to, that would be dealt with by the New Zealand government, according to New Zealand law.
But if you're an Argentine, you're governed by Argentine law. If you're an Australian in the Australian sector, you're governed by the law that applies in the Australian Capital Territory, and so on. But if you're not a member of any of those countries, then the law does not apply to you.
When members of different countries start mixing on the ice, if I go and visit the Brazilians, for instance, or the Germans at their base, it's not as clear-cut.
If a Brit has an accident or commits a crime in British Antarctic Territory, it's clear what happens. If it's somewhere else in Antarctica, on somebody else's base, then very complicated indeed as to who has legal jurisdiction, because effectively nobody does. At least that would be my reading of it. And so informally, each country tries to deal with its own events. When there's an event which involves more than one country, then there has to be some quite significant negotiation and discussion.
So that actually makes, theoretically, crimes in Antarctica a quite complicated subject to investigate.
Yes, indeed it does.
And if a man died in mysterious circumstances at the South Pole, which is a US station, and he's an Australian, and the body is brought back to New Zealand, there could be potentially an awful lot of doubt about who was responsible for what.
Yes, absolutely. The proximal responsibility would be the United States because it's their station, and I think you're referring to a particular case which was in the middle of winter, and they didn't attempt to recover the body until the following spring. Then in practice, it would be the United States who would have to investigate what happened.
But remember, Rodney's body is flown back into Christchurch, New Zealand, not the United States.
So it gets complicated. And then the person was neither a citizen of one nor the other country. It's one of the most horrid cases you could have, actually. And also you have an added feature to this, which is that it was in the middle of winter. And in the middle of winter, what happens on an Antarctic base stays on an Antarctic base. Evidence will have been disappeared just naturally. If it was first decided it was natural causes, then there would have been no reason to maintain evidence. So a lot of stuff will have been lost just because it wasn't kept, because nobody thought it needed to be. It doesn't need to have been a conspiracy. It would have just been, you know, we're living here, we're tidying up.
But if this man had suddenly died, fell in and died 36 hours later, and you didn't know what the cause of death was, you probably wouldn't be tempted to clear everything out of his office and make everything disappear, would
Well,
you?
And that's a question then as to who and when the announcement of natural causes was made. There will have been a doctor on the station. He will have been the one who will have pronounced the man dead, presumably, and will have made some initial assessment as to why. So if he now announced that it was natural causes, then NSF would have accepted that that's what the situation was and would have gone on from there. What's interesting to me is it is, although it's very, very difficult, it is possible to get into South Pole in the winter.
One year, there was a death at one of the British bases up near the coast.
And we opted to go and collect the body in the middle of winter, which was a pretty major undertaking. It would be more difficult to do into South Pole, but it has been done for medical evacuations, so it could have been done.
So Marx's body, they could have gone and collected
it. It could have come out if somebody decided to take it out or give the it enough priority. You would be risking lives to do it because it's not a simple thing to fly into South Pole in the middle of the winter, but it has been done.
But no plane does arrive to collect Rodney's body in the immediate aftermath of his sudden death. Almost 6 months go by before his body is retrieved. 6 months to speculate about how he died.
Within a few days after that, then there was a little bit of a thoughts of foul play between a few of us.
Dave, the carpenter.
We really had nothing to go off of, like any evidence, but it was just behaviors, being aware of those little subtleties, your spidey senses kind of picking up on little behavioral things, and it just didn't feel right. So there was typically three of us that would talk kind of quietly off, like, what the hell was that? Why is this person doing this or that? It just, like, maybe there is something to this. But there was nothing anyone could do. There was no police there. The autopsy was going to be done 6 months down the road. So it was just this, well, okay. You just kind of that more of disbelief where you're at and what the situation is.
Rodney's body had been placed in a body bag and taken out to the fuel arches, an area connected to the main dome by a tunnel.
Which was the coldest, most stable temperature in between these large fuel bladders where it was constantly a negative 60 to 70. And the problem with that was it was a great place to store someone like that and preserve the body for the autopsy, except Sonia, part of her job was to go through that fuel arch every day. So it was pretty much torture for her to go through there, and she knows Rodney's body is being held right there. We quickly decided we had to do something.
They decide he deserves a proper burial.
A few folks did certain specialty things. A few other folks did the interior cloth and padding, and then myself and the other carpenter went ahead and built the casket.
It takes a month to make. Dave and the other carpenters painstakingly build the 250-pound casket out of some oak planks they'd found lying around. The interior is upholstered with an old tablecloth, and Sonia makes a maple plaque with a brass inlay of Rodney's favourite constellation, Scorpio. It's quite a work of art. We are very proud of it, one of the carpenters wrote later. They place Rodney in the casket and drag him out on a traditional Nansen sled to the South Pole. A slow 1 kilometre walk over the runway and across the plateau. It's a Sunday afternoon and the sky, bright with stars, lights the way for the silent procession. Rodney's 49 crewmates gather around the pole, where the day before a group had dug a 5-foot hole in the ice in minus 75 degrees Celsius. In the momentary stillness, ice crystals start to form on their faces. Someone reads a statement from Ray, Rodney's mother. In the words of one of the men who'd helped build the casket, "We placed him into the icy grave with a great deal of cooperation and teamwork." Two people spoke, simple and elegant, and definitely cool. Rodney would think so.
Yeah, it was a very surreal, emotional kind of situation. It was very, very unique. It was needed for a lot of people, especially his girlfriend, Justonia. A few of his friends spoke, but it was pretty quiet. People were just in deep thought about the whole situation. Felt very surreal.
They mark the spot with a flag and go back inside. The 12 flags of the original Antarctic Treaty members are now joined by a 13th, this time commemorating not a nation, but a man. And there he stays for another 4 months. Life on the base returns, on the surface at least, to normal. After being cleared, Rodney's office and bedroom continue to be used just as they had been before he died. His office by other scientists, his bunk by Sonia, who lives there for the rest of the winter. And then the sun rises, and it's October.
There was a first flight coming in a little early, and we basically had to go out there, dig them up in the middle of the night, because we didn't want, of course, everyone coming in knew the stories. People were curious of what was going on, and a lot of nosy people, so we just went out in the middle of the night, dug him up, put his body, put the casket on a sled, and put some tarps over it, and then got it ready to go on the plane. So the next available plane that came in, we got his body out of there and back to New Zealand for the autopsy. Because his family ended up burying him in that casket in Australia.
At what stage did you become aware that the New Zealand police had taken an interest in this case?
Immediately. We knew that before we even left there, that the New Zealand police were going to have an interest in it.
And just a few days after Rodney leaves the South Pole, so too do Dave, Jean, and their fellow winter overs. Back in the plane for the 850 miles to McMurdo to refuel, and then another 7-hour flight to New Zealand. It's the first time they have seen open water and green for 12 months. And then they land back on solid ground in Christchurch. And yet, strangely, nobody's waiting for them. The only 49 people in the world who might have the missing piece of the puzzle, some clue as to why Rodney died, they walk through customs and catch their onward flights back home. Jean goes back to Australia, Dave to America.
It seemed to just kind of dissolve. Everyone thought they were just going to be like, we were going to be lined up and interviewed as soon as we leave there, and it was everyone just scattered. It played out a little odd, like people were just trying to brush it under the rug.
Next time, we uncover startling details about life on the ice, an isolated existence that can make you go mad.
There was a phrase that I often heard at the South Pole, which sort of described the mentality of polar expeditioners, which was, we're all here because we're not all there.
Like many people that come to Antarctica, I was hungry for adventure, and I deserve to leave that continent with memories of nothing more than that.
The Secret History of Antarctica is a Crowd Network original. It's presented by me, Stephen Davis, and produced by Anna Stauffenberg. Mixing and sound design is by Rory Alskuri. The music we use is from our partners, BMG Production Music. Thanks to Lewis Rodriguez at Sonic Space Lab Music for studio recording, and to Andy Ma for his readings. Additional material in this episode, courtesy of Ngā Toonga Sound and Vision. To binge the whole series ad-free, and for exclusive bonus episodes, subscribe to the Crowd Stories channel on the Apple Podcasts app. You can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music. If you haven't already, take a listen to the first two Secret History series. The Secret History of Flight 149 is the tale behind how a passenger plane got caught in a war zone, leaving hundreds of people at the mercy of Saddam Hussein. Hear from the human shields who were held hostage in Kuwait, and from those who've spent years searching for the truth. Series 2, The Secret History of the Estonia, is my investigation into what really happened when a passenger ferry sank in the Baltic, killing 852 people. A story of secrets, smugglers and spies that leads back to the Cold War. Find both those series on the same feed. Thanks for listening.
Crowd Network, a place where you belong.